Hello, hello. So this is the first episode of the Shropshire Witches podcast. We're going to do a bit of an introduction first. So, Amy, do you know what? You introduce yourself first and then I'll introduce myself. That seems like the polite way to do it.
Yeah, hello. So my name is Amy Boucher. I am a Shropshire folklorist and I kind of spend the most time looking at the interplay between history and folklore and how we can learn about the past through folk belief and folk tales. And I'm really excited to be here.
amazing. I'm Alex Chidley Utley and I don't have nearly as impressive credentials as Amy for stuff like this. But I do love history and I love folklore and I love ghost stories and things like that. And I grew up in South Shropshire, right up in the hills. And I think that was kind of a big part of growing up around there is that you've got the Devil's Chair and all these things. And so it was kind of a common ground. And when you and I met over Twitter and then obviously in person, we kind of realised we shared this thread of interest in the sort of more unusual things.
The weirder the better.
Yeah, I think yeah. So. Yeah, we've yet to kind of outweird one another, so which is always a good start. But I thought the best thing, or we thought the best thing with this introduction is to tell a little bit of a story that one you've got and one I've got that kind of, well, yours very much relates to your family and mine is a little bit more tenuous, but
I think it's true.
I think it's true. You go first because I love your story.
Oh, thank you. So I probably have been interested in folklore since before I even knew what the word folklore meant. Mm. And that's because when I was growing up, I was told that my granddad met the devil,
okay,
which is typical normal thing to tell your granddaughter. But yes, I was told with no uncertain terms that my granddad met the devil and it was when he was a lot younger. So I'm from Telford and the bit of Telford I grew up in is very close to the Iron Bridge and the kind of Iron Bridge Gorge. And my granddad, he grew up in Jackfield, but he used to go into Ironbridge to go to church. And he absolutely hated church. He wasn't a fan at all. So he was always trying to find ways that he could get out of going. I think it didn't help that my great-grandmother was a bit of a gossip.
Love that.
Yeah, yep, so she, like an hour at church, turned up nearer like 3 hours. So he was always trying to get out of it.
Yeah.
And one day he decided that he was going to sneak off when church began and leave, to take some mates with him. And they were going to go and play cards, which is a big no-no. If anyone knows anything about folklore, you don't play cards on a Sunday anywhere.
Not on the Sabbath,
not even in Telford. So for some reason, this worked. And St. Luke's Church in Ironbridge, it's right on the top of the gorge and there's 109 steps that go up to it, which is a killer. It's an absolute killer to get up there.
Yeah.
So he sneaks off, manages to get down there and he sat on the church steps and they start playing cards. Mm-hmm. Absolutely brilliant. They're having a whale of a time, really enjoying themselves. And then they feel a big cold gust of wind and a tap on the shoulder. Now, rather annoyingly, my granddad never described the devil, which is a bit rude considering, you know, he didn't realise I was going to grow up to be a folklorist. So he turned round and he locked eyes with Old Scratch himself. And Old Scratch told him in no uncertain terms that if he didn't stop behaving the way he was behaving, he would be seeing a lot more of him and he would actually end up with him when it came to the end. Now, my granddad told this story to various people in the family and I think he was a bit of a natural storyteller.
Like
there's a bit of a ruder word you could say for it. And I think it became so ingrained in our family folklore that we never played games on a Sunday. We weren't allowed to, you know, even go on the Xbox and things because the devil might get us, despite the fact that none of us were Christian.
Yeah.
So I think that natural interest came from a family, bit of family folklore. And then the more I looked into the stories we have in Telford, the stories we have in Shropshire, I've just been hooked ever since. So I think that's where my origin, my arc, my villain arc came from and why I do what I do.
That's brilliant. And I think it is really fascinating. And I suppose historically as well, most people, I mean, there's a kind of a herd mentality in terms of believing, you know, things that you're told. But in terms of like personal stories, that goes through history as to why people get a real affinity with certain things. So your interest in folklore was ignited by a story that really is quite creepy as well. And perfect to the county that we're in as well, because the devil seems to loom quite large here, doesn't he?
Loves it round here. He spends so much time just bobbing from Shrewsbury to the Devil's Chair to Telford. He's all over the place.
He just loves it.
He loves it.
And whether he's taking exception to either the people of Shrewsbury or the Welsh or whomever it is, it depends, doesn't it?
Yes.
Whoever you're talking to is he dislikes. But the story, so ours, or I say ours as a family, but mine, our late granddad used to tell me this story, and I always thought it's quite funny. And then I looked it up, and there was a character, whether she's true or not, I don't know, but certainly historically there is a character that used to live out near Pulverbatch Way, and she was called Betty Chidley. And again, it varies. So some people say she was in the 19th century, some 18th, some 17th. The stories vary, so we don't know whether she existed. I like to think that she did.
I do too.
I think it's much cooler that way. But she was a bit of a sort of, and I suppose when we go into the podcast, we'll talk more about that in terms of women on the kind of peripheral of society. But she was one of those. Yeah. So probably post-menopausal, unmarried, it seems, and whether she had children, things we don't know. But she is that kind of caricature of what you think of a sort of an eccentric woman that
goals.
Would be exact. Yeah, absolute goals that would be dubbed a witch. And she lived on the outskirts in that sort of area, which is not so far from where we live now. And there was, it wasn't uncommon in those times, obviously, to go to farms and things for arms, which she did. And one day she went there, and it wasn't the farmer, it was the farmer's wife, who was not as receptive to her visiting and sent her out with a flea in her ear, basically. And she then cursed them, and the cow stopped producing milk until such a time that they sourced it back to her and tried to make amends. And then she came back and made it right, and the cow did produce milk again. And again, these stories vary. Some talk about calves sickening and dying. Sometimes it's as perfunctory as the cow not having milk. You know, again, it all varies according to where you read it and according to who you talk to. Granddad's was a little bit more straightforward, and the cow just didn't produce milk. And then when they kind of made it right, she did. But because our surname's Chidley, he always claims that she was real and that we were related to her. And I really hope it's true. Because actually there was a story, which is a true story, which I find interesting, is that our great-grandfather passed away of a heart attack in his 50s, which nowadays you would know as heart disease, but this was the early 1950s. And their farm out near Astley Way, a woman, a traveller had come there selling things, and he sent her out on her way, and she said that he would die unexpectedly. And our grandmother was a witness to this, and she was scared to death of this woman. And he died not so long afterwards. I think it was a year or a couple of years afterwards, very suddenly. And so as a family, they always remember that story and always felt it was an omen. And some have kind of poo-pooed it as nonsense. But I don't know. I think we're inherently superstitious. So part of me goes, oof, a little bit creepy.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's what's so interesting about folklore, is that you can have British folklore and then that is in various regions that kind of has mirrors and there's archetypes.
Yeah.
Then you've got regional folklore that's very specific to the region you're in.
Mm.
But then also you have these family stories, and I think they're all just as valid and just as interesting. And one thing I particularly like about Betty Chidley in some versions of the story is that when they get her to the farm and tell her to, you know, sort it out, she says, "I swear on my God that it will be fixed." And the absolute queen is like, "My God," and nothing happens. The cow continues to be sick and continues not to produce milk.
Yeah.
And then they click, because she's a witch, she will be inevitably linked to the devil, and they drag her back and say, "Right, no, you swear on our God, swear on the true God, the God in heaven." And she reluctantly does it, and it's all fixed.
Yeah.
And I just think she's a legend, and like her descendant, she's an absolute legend.
Yeah. Oh, thank you so much. Yeah, I mean, I think she's a lot more exciting. I'm kind of there watching the Antiques Roadshow and things like that. So if we are related, she would probably be slightly underwhelmed, I think. But I hope that it is true, so we've got some kind of link with talking about this type of thing. So should we go into talking about witches?
Yes, that would be really exciting.
So in terms of, I suppose we could probably, because how do you get such a broad subject and put it down into a fairly condensed amount of time? Your angle here, because I suppose my interest in the witches is the history of it, but also is some of the texts like Malleus Maleficarum, trials and things like that. But yours is much more of the folkloric. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, that's fair. And I think I've specifically looked at the county of Shropshire.
Yeah.
When I look at witch folklore and witch lore,
yeah,
I tend to focus on Shropshire, Welsh borders kind of area. because it's in some ways it's so typical to the region and the wider region of British kind of witch lore and witch involvement, but then in other ways it's very different, and there's quite, I wouldn't want to say acceptance, but there's for example, there's less witch trials that happen here. We don't have many actual records of witch trials that have happened in the county. And we have a few situations that might be witch trials, but we're not quite sure, because either the records have been lost. But it seems to be that less people in Shropshire are actually being tried as being a witch than in other parts of England, Wales and Scotland, Ireland, which kind of leads one to think that it maybe either wasn't very common, which we know from the folklore isn't the case, or that it was so ingrained in public consciousness and society that actually the distinction between what was witchcraft and what was everyday kind of herbalism and beliefs was actually so distorted, really. So it's fascinating.
That is so extraordinary, because I suppose stripping back again in terms of like what a witch is, so the word's Anglo-Saxon, isn't it, I believe? Yeah. And so in terms of, so if we talk maybe kind of, as we go along, maybe we could kind of go broader, but I think if we look at the British Isles, it's probably the easiest way to do it, isn't it? Because obviously then it goes into a hugely convoluted and much longer subject. But if we looked at the idea of a witch, so in terms of what you're saying, we're looking more at the cunning folk and things like that, aren't
yeah,
we?
Yes, so, certainly in Shropshire.
And do you want to kind of explain what that is, basically, for context?
So cunning folk, there's various different ways you could describe it, but it tends to be people that are used in a community for a specific purpose. Now, that could be for herbalism and herbal remedies. It could be midwifery. It could be divination and fortune telling. But they are commodified in their community.
Yeah.
But often they are actually ostracized by that same community. So traditionally, they tended to live on the outskirts of society. They would live literally within, outside of the boundaries of the village or the area they were living. So they were indicative to the area, but they were not polite company. And there's a number of different examples, Betty Chidley being one of them, of people like that in the county, even going all the way into the 19th and even the early 20th century. So there's a lady who was known as Molly Delight, which, excellent name.
Great
sounds
name.
Like a drag queen.
Yeah, I was going to say, absolutely, I'm all over that, yeah.
And Molly Delight was supposedly living...
Sorry. How do you... Yeah, love. I love, love her it. Already. Whatever she's done, I love
her. Queen. Yeah, queen. And she was supposedly meant to live in at the foot of the Wrekin around about the 1950s.
Okay. Oh, wow. Okay.
So it's very, very late. Yeah. And the local community feared her because she was a little bit eccentric. She fits that archetype again of a woman kind of postmenopausal, a bit eccentric, not really acceptable.
Yeah.
And they all believed that she was a witch, and the local community would avoid her when they crossed paths with her, and they would generally just try and get away from her as much as possible. And she was said to do all sorts of things. She was said to walk around speaking tongues, which is quite cool. And she was supposed to walk around with a box of toads, which weirdly is something that we see paralleled to quite a lot of Shropshire's witch folklore, is that we love toads. We love keeping toads in boxes, and we love feeding them with things like communion bread and things that are really sinful.
Yeah, can toads eat bread?
I don't know. Probably not. But
box dead box.
But yeah, we certainly like to try and feed them communion bread in Shropshire. And she was said to be like that. But it's interesting because you've got this wonderful eccentric figure that even if she wasn't practicing divination or herbalism or anything like that, the community has said she's a witch. But that's in the 50s. And I think what fascinates me with Shropshire's relationship with witches is that it's a very long history, and it's can be witnessed even in times where we would see as it not happening before.
Yeah. It's fascinating. But the thing is, I think this, and I suppose we'll probably do this, where rather than following kind of chronologically, I think you just kind of go from era to, it sort of stays relevant, doesn't it? And I think this, like by our essence, if you look at the crux of it, we are inherently superstitious, I think. I think that's it. Because
I think
even those that people say, oh, you know, I'm a person of science, I'm not superstitious. I think in our general day-to-day lives, most of us are. So, for example, most of us will salute magpies and things like that. So even if we're not practicing Christians, those are the birds that apparently didn't cry at the crucifixion. And so they've still got this long-standing history where people salute them and try to keep them happy. apart from the Victorians, who obviously tried to drive them to extinction. But in terms of witches and things like that, what I think is so interesting is this idea of the cunning folk, or, you know, maybe then a little bit later, the wise woman. But it's a tradition that goes right back into antiquity, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, yeah. And I think, and you know, one of the things I did find really interesting was, you know, double toil and trouble. I can never remember the next bit, but that in the Scottish play, I should say, is actually from part of it's from a poem, the Roman poet Horace as well, which I think is really fascinating. So these ideas that even at the time would have been, because of things like demonology with James I, would have been sort of current text. There was always an underbelly of an awareness of what witches were.
Yes, yeah.
Which I think, you know, because if you look historically, what was interesting is in the ancient world, so apparently the Romans, I think, kind of had more witch trials or killed more people than ever did in the times that we consider kind of the witch trials, not in modernity, but like in the more modern world, yeah, as we would think of them. But a lot of these witches, particularly in the UK, were generally women. Of course, we can get into that. But it was this idea of a witch sort of came into being in the early part of the medieval period, and then sort of, because of Christianity, kept falling short, because everyone kept thinking, I think maybe you'll think this is right, that because of God, well, he wouldn't allow somebody that was genuinely evil like that. And so it didn't really ever catch on until the Catholics, who were like, hold my pint, kind of medieval England. And they were just like, right, now we've got it. And it's interesting, because I think this is where we kind of come into your cunning folk and things, is that is when, rather than it being something that God had kind of arranged or was against God, it was more a person against a person.
Yes.
So this idea of the cunning person changed from someone who was helping in the village but still slightly ostracized, became somebody that could genuinely affect you, like could cause impotence or something like that. And as we go on, we'll realize that they're very penis centric.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Especially if the men are writing about witches, they love to talk about penises. But that idea of like the shift from a cunning person to suddenly being somebody that could really cause you harm, would you say that's probably about right, that it kind of came into that era? Maybe the shift was when it sort of, everyone always thinks it's deeply religious, but a lot of it's secular, because it became more of a state with the size courts, and yeah, particularly going into maybe the 17th century, there was a shift, wasn't there?
Yeah, I definitely agree. And I think it's that idea of the potential for harm,
yeah,
and how easily one could potentially harm someone, mm-hmm, through very basic methods, very simple terms. Even the Bible could be used in the Shropshire context,
yeah, okay,
to cause harm to another person. So there's certain psalms in the Bible that if you read them out at certain occasions, they can actually cause death and misfortune. One of them is Psalm 109, and if you read that out at a wedding, supposedly it's meant to cause death, destruction. It's meant to harm the bride and the groom.
Oh my God.
But also the vicar that is doing the actual ceremony. So the poor chap's just doing his job, and someone's took umbrage because, I don't know, someone stole her man, and she's, you know, so the thing is, in Shropshire, the Shropshire context is you can harm someone with the simplest of things. And going back to the Bible, there was, yeah, a woman in the 19th century in Much Wenlock, mm-hmm, that spoke to Charlotte Byrne, who said, oh no, I avoid the Bible because there's more harm than good in that book, because in her secularized kind of world, away from the church, there were so many ways in which you could curse or harm people with, yeah, something as simple. And I think that also kind of links to illiteracy and literacy, the idea that they could physically read that book in a community that might not necessarily be able to do that. But it is fascinating the simple ways in which you can just harm your enemy.
Yeah, I yeah, just think that's really interesting. I think the wedding thing, I think, is fantastic.
Yeah,
you know, like nowadays, if anyone's got an objection, stand up. But this guy's like, she's got the Bible. Like, Jesus Christ, she's gonna not 109 or whichever one it was. Like,
yeah,
just yeah, and then just like utter carnage. Just yeah, I mean, that would kind of spice things up a bit. But I suppose, okay, like within those sort of parameters. So let's look at maybe. Do you know what? Should we just go to our little friend Matthew Hopkins? Because I know that's, yes, I know that's Suffolk and all that thing. But there is a guy, okay. Because I know. I think you do have a story, don't you? I think, is it about a maybe somebody similar character, or either he came to Shropshire or someone similar? Is this
yes,
right?
So should, so I, supposedly,
you tell this story. Yeah,
there was an apprentice to Matthew Hopkins called Gideon Peake.
Great.
And Gideon Peake was meant to have come to Shropshire to destroy the witches there.
Yeah.
But there was that many witches within the community that they basically gave him the same treatment as the witches themselves, and they actually killed him.
Oh, bloody hell.
Which is kind of... There's no actual evidence that he existed, but folklorically... It would make sense because he went down to South Shropshire and we all know what they're like down there.
Yeah, here. Feral.
Yeah, absolutely feral. And particularly in like the Clee Hills area, it's supposed to be a bastion of the devil. It's supposed to be a stronghold of witches. And there was a vicar supposedly in the 1880s that moved to the area.
Yeah.
And he was told in no uncertain terms to preach of witchcraft's ills because he would end up coming undone and have curses put on him. And supposedly it was the schoolmaster that told him. So it was a relatively educated chap, which you can kind of see in two ways. You can either see it as absolute folk horror vibe of, you know, you come to my community and say that's bad, like the Wicker Man, or just how saturated these beliefs are in the communities that we are talking about. And also that sometimes the distinction between what would be witchcraft and what isn't witchcraft was so blurred, because even there is a number of things in Shropshire that are preventative measures to stop witches coming into your house, like Rowan Wood crosses above the door and stuff like that. So technically that is still a charm, that is still a piece of witchcraft, but it's to stop witches.
Yeah.
So certainly, even though we can't prove Gideon Peake was real, I love the idea of it actually happening.
because
the whole area he was supposed to have visited to was so... witchcraft was so ingrained in the community. And also there's a brilliant nursery rhyme that supposedly he becomes a ghost that is haunting the area, still trying to rid the area of witches. So we both better be careful.
Yeah, I was going to say Gideon. It's like, giddy up, he's coming for you. But I think that's... And I suppose, like, whilst... I mean, I love that. And I think whilst Matthew Hopkins obviously demonstrably existed, he was at a time... where that was kind of almost like, not at its peak as such, but like he hugely moved that forward, but he was playing on people's angst, wasn't he?
Yes,
and maybe given our proximity to Wales and things, we'd kind of resided still in the old world with the old beliefs and things like that. But Matthew self-proclaimed with which funder general, isn't it?
Yes.
You just think, what a knob. I'm sorry. Like, if you're going to give yourself a title, like, he's like, do you know what? I think this is what I'm going to call myself. And, you know, I think his image is kind of iconic with his boots and his little hat and everything. And he just looks so self-important, doesn't he?
I just think it's
amazing. And I didn't realise actually until recently that he died really young as well. I think, wasn't he about 25? And they thought he died of tuberculosis or horrible.
Yeah, very young. Yeah.
I mean, probably not undeserved in a way, but if you're going to look at kind of karma. But
it was the witches.
He came undone, didn't he? I think, without a doubt. But it was, I just thought it was so fascinating that he went from, I think, was it starting in Suffolk and then went across the country, but particularly kind of, he was sort of East Anglian and around there. But this kind of movement picked up, and he's one of those that really sort of started it. So people like Gideon, and whether Gideon was real or not, it's absolutely palpable, the fear that must have spread, in the same way that if you look at something like, just for example, off topic a bit, but something like the Yorkshire Ripper, where for years, because obviously he wasn't caught for so long, people thought that he was turning up all over the country and people were living in actual like fear. And I'm trying to think of the same sort of level of fear that would have been across the country, that people thought any minute somebody can turn against somebody else. Because they say, don't they, one of the ways that you could almost absolve yourself or you know, it was basically by pointing the finger at somebody else.
Yeah.
Like Pendle, for example, was a good example of that. But also you get cases, I suppose, where children maybe are asked, and if they're children from bigger families who didn't really have much attention and things like that, suddenly you've got, you know, an assizes of a trial of and looking at you, kind of asking you questions. They're going to run with that. So I think Matthew Hopkins is another example of somebody that really just knew how to manipulate situations. I mean, do you think he genuinely believed in witchcraft like this, or do you think he was just somebody that had got, I mean, undoubtedly a lot of problems, but do you think he was exercising personal things like sexual frustration and things, and witchcraft was just happened to work for him, or do you think he genuinely thought he was doing good? Because while you answer that, I'm going to find these quotes that I wrote down by him as well, because the guy was nuts.
So I think it's difficult to, because I think it's one and the same. I think the early modern mind was very ingrained that it was an actual thing, that there was actual demons, there was actual spirits, and there was actual witches. So there would always have been people. I think there's a tendency to think that everyone in the past believed was mono in one idea, and there was, you know, no other ideas. There was people that would be a lot more pragmatic, and they wouldn't believe in witches and wouldn't believe in spirits and stuff. But I think it was so ingrained in the thinking that I think he definitely was a misogynist. I mean,
I think that's
card carrying.
Yeah. You know? he's the poster boy for that.
Yeah,
he?
But
he
I think it. Certainly there would have been within his complex personality an element of him potentially doing God's work.
Yeah.
Just because the time period in which he lived in and the ideas that were around in that community. It's a very strange period of I mean, history's just strange, isn't it?
In general, yeah.
It is a very strange period of history, and looking a lot of the work I do when I'm writing about the devil in Shropshire is the shift in mentality from the devil being a really tangible creature that can crawl down chimneys and destroy your farms and your homes to being this kind of figure that you poke fun at in the 18th and 19th centuries. So I think certainly there would be an element of him actually believing what he was doing was the right thing to do in a really twisted kind of way.
Yeah, so it's because it's convoluted, isn't it, I suppose. But he said, for many years known the devil's mark and found to have, they're obsessed with this, three teats about her, which honest women hath not. This idea, so we're looking again like the devil. So I suppose by the 18th, 19th century, it does become quite sort of bum-centric, where they obviously, like, usually like the devil, they start to have figures where something happens to their bum usually, doesn't it? Like someone gets like stabbed or something. Like they always have a bare arse or something like that. And I think when you look at the kind of 15th, 16th, 17th century, they're much more cock-centric, but also they are absolutely, and this is, I've got to say, and I'm not just going to go from a kind of, I'm going to go from a female perspective, but in terms of this male thing, I want to see what you think as well, and maybe if there are any records of this in Shropshire, but they are so focused on the idea of any kind of mark, you know, in terms of like a blemish, a birthmark, anything like that, or third teat, as they love to call it. They also had this idea of obsessed with sucking, so they would sort of, an imp or whatever it may be, can suck between somebody's fingers. And they had, so like in demonology, so James the First, raging misogynist as well, said that the devil's semen was cold. Quite often they don't really give you explicit reasons why, do they? They're
it just
like,
is.
Yeah, his jizz is cold, okay? So just like, make of that what you will. But like Malleus Maleficarum, and we've got to talk about this. So, and his name, I can never say it properly, but we'll call him Heinrich Cramner. Can you say it better than me?
Probably not, no.
That'll do.
Yeah, that'll do.
He wrote this in the 15th century, and it took off because fortuitous timing around the same time as a printing press. So this flew, okay? And I don't know whether anything like that reached Shropshire or if you've got similar examples of that kind of influence in Shropshire, but it was fascinating. He was born in Alsace, which obviously at the time was Germany, and he was a Dominican monk. But it was interesting that the church quite quickly were like, I think not. Like, you know, they quite quickly, not like wash their hands of it strictly, because I know a couple of bills were passed that sort of tried to reinstate this view, but mostly it was secular. And it was really interesting because the stuff he said, so as I've mentioned before, and you know, a few of my friends as well, this idea of his fixation with women wanting to sever cocks, like that's his word, he didn't say cocks obviously, but he said that women were guilty of the wholesale theft of a penis. So, like, your views on that? This guy thinks that women, a sign of witchcraft, is that they're severing penises and keeping them. Which, like, is that going to be useful to you? Do you find that?
No, I don't really know what I
what would you do with them? Like, it's
maybe keep it in a box, like the toads?
Yeah! Sure, we've got toads. And the Alsatians are like, well, we've got boxes of cocks. Like, what are you going to do with those? Is there anything?
It always reminds me of, you know, that medieval kind of drawing of the tree of penises, you know, and there's the nun just picking them.
Picking the cock.
Because it's this idea of demasculinity and reducing your masculinity to your genitalia. And
yeah, I think
if a woman is in any way different from the archetype of what she should be,
yeah,
she's going to steal your willy.
Yeah.
And it's just hilarious.
She'll do that.
I think, I don't know I don't know how well that was believed. I'd like to think that people in the past didn't literally think that there was a woman with a box of willies in the corner.
It's what it represented,
yeah,
rather than it being like, oh,
it
God.
Is. It really demonstrates not only the misogyny of the past, but also the obsession with the male phallus and the obsession with the fact that that's what it means to be a man. Because that's what I take from it, is that he is clearly unwell.
The guy's ill.
He's like, ill.
Let's just beat around the bush. Yeah.
But he is reducing manhood to being your manhood.
To being a severed cock. Yeah. Which to bash somebody around with. But like, here's the quote, and I just love this. So I'll try and do it justice. Witches who in this way sometimes collect male organs in great numbers, as many as 20 or 30 members together, and put them in a bird's nest or shut them up in a box.
So it is a box.
It is a box. Where they move themselves like living members and eat oats and corn. Yeah, so there you go. So severed cocks. Like the cocks are eating. Also, poor birds, because you return to your young and it's like, oh, 37 penises, something, what's happened? Where are my baby magpies? Well, actually, it wouldn't be a magpie's nest. They would not tolerate that. Like, no. Magpies would be like, do not come here with your severed cocks, mate. Go on, crap, go elsewhere. Take that to somewhere else. And the last quote I want to read by him, because I think he was so obsessed, and this is not exclusive to this guy, but he's the pin-up for it. He's so obsessed that women are obsessed with sex. And I think, mate, there is only one person obsessed with sex here. And I think, and he ain't getting it. I can see that. But he said, besides such, and I wonder if he was impotent as well, and that's why he's cock-centric. But besides such impotency in this act is sometimes due to the coldness of nature or sometimes natural defect. It is asked how it is possible to distinguish whether it is due to witchcraft or not. So when the member is in no way stirred and can never perform the act of coitus, this is a sign of frigidity of nature. But when it is stirred and becomes erect but yet cannot perform, this is witchcraft. So I like that.
Blame the woman.
Yeah, but he's like sort of kind of explaining away that some elements of impotency are natural, but otherwise there's a kind of coven of women behind this. Are there anything in terms of, because you're so good on Shropshire history, are there any kind of accounts of things like this or these type of things taking influence in Shropshire, or do you feel that they maybe didn't reach places like this, not in the same way?
Not in the same way. I think there's certainly a lot of focus on the power that these women have. And interestingly, in Shropshire, there are a lot of male cunning folk. You've got the excellently named Dick Spot the Conjurer, which is very linked to what we've been talking
to. Yeah, I was going to say, warming to the theme. Perfect.
It's, Dick Spot the Conjurer. just to mention that name again, Dick Spot.
Has he given himself that name, or is that?
Yeah, I think so. And then there's Thomas Light.
Yeah.
And Thomas Light was a wizard who was meant to, and a cunning folk who was supposed to battle the devil every evening in the streets.
Exhausting.
He was probably very hench to be able to fight the devil. And he had beef with another wizard.
Yeah.
And they used to send each other poisoned gifts and different things. And in the end, he culminated in this wizard's death. so there are kind of, it's a bit different in Shropshire because there are male cunning folk too that are doing evil things, and weirdly a lot of the male magic practitioners seem to do a lot of magic that's focused on like cockfighting, again very linked to what we've been talking about.
Cockerels, though,
yes, cockerels
fighting. Yeah,
and work within more of the male domain with cockfighting and trying to work out who's going to be billeted to the army and things like that. But women seem to do more harm to children and also to kind of farm animals.
Yeah.
So there's a lot in Shropshire of the harm that can be done to cattle, to livestock, to anything that's the agrarian kind of lifestyle. Yeah. And I think that's very reflective of the world that Shropshire was prior to the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, what we call it kind of thing.
Yeah, but there's not as much about penises in Shropshire.
Not as much as we'd like.
Not as much as we'd like.
I wonder if that's a literacy thing as well in terms
of,
and that's not to make assumptions, but maybe this is much more. And I suppose when you come up here, so like we had Gideon, but even witch trials and things, they go up to Pendle, of course, and then again, like most famously, perhaps out of England, Salem. But some of these, I mean, they were going all across the UK, but some, for whatever reason, seem to carry more fame than others, like Pendle. So what do you think that, so, I mean, maybe because you've got another fabulous name, Old Demdike.
Yeah.
She died in jail, I think. But there was comparatively few, I mean, too many, but still few women murdered judiciously, of course. I can never say that word, but, you know, like in terms of the law. But there are other places where many more were killed, but there are certain witch trials that carry more infamy. What do you think the reason for that is?
So I think certain areas, I think it goes back to that relationship with these kind of practices. Mm. And in Shropshire, there was a relationship that went beyond the being witchcraft.
Yeah.
So when we talk about witchcraft in Shropshire, it's not that there's this continuation of paganism all the way through into the modern era.
Yeah.
That's just not evidence. Mm. The people that we're talking about that are doing these kind of witchcraft activities would be in church on a Sunday and they would be Christians.
Yeah.
It's just a folk practice that they have either inherited or learnt about or that they have had passed down to them.
Mm.
It's simply not the case that it's this continuation of paganism or they've all kissed the devil's ass kind of thing.
Because they love, yeah.
Which they love.
The idea of that, yeah.
So I think because it's so ingrained within the community, go back to the Clee Hills, that vicar being told, don't even bother, mate, because everyone's doing it.
No point. Yeah.
There just wasn't the evidence to kind of try people for these crimes. There was maybe, I can never remember whether it's 6 or 5 genuine cases of witchcraft being tried in Shropshire.
Okay.
One of which was in the 1750s, and it was a lady called Bessie.
Okay.
Of Bellevue, and she was
Bellevue. Yeah.
And she was tried for witchcraft, but we don't know what the punishment was. Mm. We don't know what, because that's been lost. Sadly, quite a lot of our records in Shropshire were destroyed in a fire in Much Wenlock.
Okay.
So we don't have as much as we'd like to see.
I mean, that in itself is quite gothic.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of, I mean, that seems quite appropriate. Yeah.
Yeah. There's another case that is often referred to as being witchcraft, but we're not sure, in 1545, and it's of a young girl known as Alice Glasson.
Mm.
And Alice Glasson was tried, and she was actually hanged in Much Wenlock, and she was only 11 years old.
Oh,
so it's incredibly sad. And to think what that young girl must have gone through prior to her death and on her death, it is a tragedy all round. But we don't know why she was actually put to death because those records have been lost.
Yeah.
And the two theories we've seen is that it's either murder or witchcraft.
Yeah.
But she's probably one of the only ones I've come across that's actually been put to death or potentially witchcraft in Shropshire. But again, it could be murder or another trial. But she is one of the youngest people in Britain, to my knowledge, that's ever had the death sentence.
It's really sad.
It really is. And I think there's a tendency when we look at the past to forget that they're humans. And I think the idea of an 11-year-old girl at the start of her life, for whatever reason she was in that situation, losing her life is a tragedy all round, whether witchcraft or not. And then the other ones that we do have, particularly in the early modern period, are trials that end up with either some sort of public humiliation or that kind of thing. So we've got Mother Garve of Castle Foregate in Shrewsbury, 1579, and she was supposed to have bewitched cattle again, and she was sentenced to the pillory.
Okay.
There's another woman whose name has just left me. Where is she? Mary Bebb. How could I forget Mary Bebb?
Mary Bebb.
And Mary Bebb was tried for profanely uttering 67 curses.
I love how approximate that is.
Yeah.
Why do they do it? Because you could say a handful, but if someone says 67, you're like, well, you just kind of,
how
do you know that?
So she was supposedly tried for 67 curses. Now, that could be that she's just got an absolute potty mouth.
Yeah.
But it's more likely, given the context, that she was a bit of a bad one and she was cursing everybody.
There were 67.
Oh. Yeah. So we have a snaffling. Snaffling isn't really a word, but I like it.
There's a snaffling.
We have a snaffling.
It's a word today.
Yeah.
Snaffling. Yeah.
Of these trials in Shropshire, but there's just not really the momentum to try witches in the same way that you have in other areas. And I think that's partially why. I think it's in other areas, it's linked to kind of the hysteria that was associated with them. So Pendle, for instance, there was absolute hysteria surrounding it. It was the community all turning on each other.
Yeah.
And it's a good story. Just take away the tragedy of these women and
reality
the,
of it,
the absolute reality of how awful it must have been to live within those communities. It's a good story. And I think human beings, we love a good story. And, and if you think about all of folklore and all of history, particularly oral history and oral traditions, the things that continue are the stories that matter and the stories that captivate people. So it's the same with everything. It's the same with ghosts. The there will probably be thousands and millions of different ghost stories that have been lost. We continue the ones that matter. And I think that's very much the same with Pendle, is that in that community, that story mattered. And in a way, it could even be linked to kind of the collectivized trauma of that community dealing with the aftermath of these things. And then it's carried on through history and continued to be told, lost some of its original trauma and its original meaning, and become almost sensational like it was at the time. So I think certain events like Pendle become sensationalized more than others. We don't have anything in Shropshire you could really sensationalize massively, other than Mary Bebb uttering those curses. It doesn't impact in the same way. And I think from my research, I've definitely seen within Shropshire, there's not the momentum to try witches. We even some of the ones that have been tried, there was one at Sutton Hall, there was a witch trial actually took place in Sutton Hall, and the judge acquitted the person involved because it wasn't seen as something that probably was a priority. Or it's very interesting to look at the minds of the people that are going through this and work out why in some areas you've got women stealing penises and causing rack and ruin to men.
Supposedly.
Yeah. But then in other communities, it's just something that's very ingrained. So it is, it's fascinating.
It's extraordinary. And I think you made a really interesting point there in terms of, I suppose, looking at when something goes from the realms of factual to folkloric.
Yes.
And I suppose even if, again, slightly off topic, but something like Jack the Ripper, where there are these heinous crimes.
Yeah.
And for a long time, within living memory, and certainly, I mean, not so much now, but, you know, going into the 20th century, but they become figures of folklore. And for whatever reason, certain stories like Pendle, and again, Salem's another example. When I think in total, there was something like seven, I can't remember how many people, but around 15 women, seven men, something like that. One man was crushed to death. It was awful, but relatively small compared to what was going on in Germany and other places. But you almost have like a sort of cookery book of what is the ideal situation. And in Pendle, you've got a child that turns against their family, obviously usually under duress. But you've got an old woman on the periphery of society. You've got Lancaster Jail. You've got all this recipe for a really good story, whilst also trying to remember that this happened. And it's the same in Scotland. I don't know, I can't remember the date, but very recently these women were sort of absolved, weren't they, of guilt, which I thought was interesting because that also implies guilt originally, but you're not absolving them of something that they couldn't have been. Because, you know, I think that's interesting, this idea of saying, you know, they were wrongly killed and we absolve them of being witches. Well, it wasn't probably something they could actually be. And what was interesting, if you feel the same, is witch as a term, as we said, is Anglo-Saxon, but actually wasn't really applied by people who had a genuine affection or belief in that type of thing. It was usually used as an insult.
Yes.
So something like these days, if you look at it, say these days we would call, you know, women varying words, of which I won't necessarily say, but historically, how do you insult somebody or ignite any fear and is a witch? And I suppose we could look at, because you touched on punishments and things, and maybe that could be interesting to talk about as well. But this kind of frenzy, the way it affects society, a lot of societies, when it happened, afterwards started to recognise that obviously with things like, you know, climate shifts and things like that, started to realise that actually communities who'd had witch trials didn't benefit. So Shropshire maybe didn't have as many or whatever the record may be, but would have started to see that maybe places like Shropshire were either doing the same or better than places that have been decimated by witch trials.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really interesting. They started to sort of almost reflect and think, you know, this obviously hasn't worked for us. And it was almost sort of swept away as this kind of an embarrassing relative, you know, they just kind of think, well, like, let's just put a bit of a you know, a cork in that and not think about it. And I suppose what's interesting is earlier as well, I think you slightly touched on markings in terms of like things like apotropaic marks, which I think, you know, you know a lot about, are really interesting. So you do see a hangover that went well into the 17th century of marks, things that were done on doorways, hearths, windows, as a kind of, I suppose, like a burglar alarm, wasn't it? Because in a non-secular society, they totally believed that these people could come and get them.
Yeah.
I mean, that in the kind of the older beliefs I find fascinating. By the 16th, 17th century, these people were genuinely afraid that this could come and get them as much as someone could break in your house and kill you. They totally believed it, didn't they? And they believed it could affect their fertility. They believed all sorts. I mean, do you want to talk us through some of the witch marks, you know, like concentric circles, things like that?
Yeah. So one of my favourite examples was actually discovered in 1882.
Yeah.
So I found it via newspaper records. Mm-hmm. So it's not clear how old this actually was.
Yeah.
But it's hinted at it's being an 1800s example. So yeah. There was a chap in Madeley, which is where I'm from, and he was cleaning out his chimney in his house, an old brick chimney, and he found a scrap of paper that had a wax seal on it that had the following lines written on it. "I charge all witches and ghosts to depart from this house in the name of Jehovah and Alpha and Omega," which is brilliant.
Amazing.
Powerful, powerful move.
Yeah.
But also, it's really interesting to think that this idea that, yes, these markings were being used a little bit earlier and these kind of things to protect the house were being used earlier, but we've got examples from the 1800s. Yeah. Now, the man knew he didn't put it there, because he didn't, but he didn't know how that had got there, but he knew, and it was still very, very well kind of known and understood that this was something to protect the house. Mm-hmm. I mean, it literally says it on there, but there was an awareness of these things. I always think of the ones at Boscobel House, the burn marks, because they are there to give you that extra layer of security. Mm-hmm. And there's various ways in which you can do it in Shropshire, but that's possibly one of my favourites. So in South Shropshire, little rowan crosses were made out of rowan wood, and they were hung over the doors.
Okay.
And they were supposed to keep witches specifically out of the house.
Yeah.
They may or may not keep the devil out, they said, but they definitely knew that witches would be out if they saw the rowan wood. Other examples are, there's a lot of coins left either on the underneath the threshold or the kind of the mantle of the doorway, and they were supposed to keep witches and the devil away. As well as that, things like mummified cats have been found. There's at least one example in Ludlow of a mummified cat that was found buried. And cats are interesting because they've got that, obviously, in the modern mind and before that, link to witches.
Yeah.
But that was said to be able to keep witches out of the house. But even things like chimney stacks seem to really have a prominence in Shropshire as a way that the witch or the devil can come into the house.
Yeah.
So there's number of examples of kind of threshold patterns, but not being drawn on the doorway, but actually on the hearthstone.
Oh, and interesting. Yeah, of course.
They would get like oak leaves, or it tended to be oak leaves. They were one of the more prominent ones, but other trees as well. And they would draw these intricate patterns on the hearthstone that was said to prevent the devil and witches from entering via the chimney.
Yeah.
So there's a number of ways in which you can protect your home in variously easy ways, like quite common household items. So it's quite interesting because you've got the potential to cause harm with everyday objects and common household things, but also you can arm yourself and protect yourself with common household things. Another one is shoes. We've got a number of examples of concealed shoes in Shropshire, and that's meant to be something that can keep witches out as well. So there were ways in which the modern mind, not the modern mind, the minds at the time thought that they could protect themselves. Yeah. And I think what's really interesting to me about folklore and various forms of folklore, from death omens and folklore of death all the way through to what we're talking about now with witches, is that these things exist in the intangible. We can't understand necessarily how a witch can fly down the chimney, or the devil can. We don't understand why a child dies. We don't understand why our cattle are dying.
Yeah.
But if we follow these uniform kind of ideas that have been in our community for as long as the hills, we can prevent it. And it's a way of us trying to manage the intangible, I think. And I think that is across the board within all sorts of folklore, and it's probably something I'll touch on in future episodes, but I think certainly with concealed objects and markings, and that's why so many of them are on churches, it's a way to govern and control the uncontrollable.
It's fascinating, isn't it? And I think it's that idea. And I suppose in terms of medieval times, if you were looking at people that would have slept in you know, the Great Hall and things like that, there was a fear, I suppose, or an element of trust was placed in who you were sleeping with when there was a lot of people sleeping in the same space.
Yeah.
But this idea of foreign bodies coming in terms of things from outside felt as present as perhaps now, that we'd be afraid of people breaking in and things. It was tangible to them. I think another thing that was really interesting to me is when you look at things like stately homes, when they sometimes have rugs with a sort of almost, it's like a big symbol in the middle, like a red, which is like supposed to be the eye, isn't it?
Yeah.
And they had concentric circles, because this idea that a witch or whatever it may be could get into a circle but can't get out. And where would you hide? You can't hide in a circle.
Yeah.
There's sort of logic behind what might seem a little bit obtruse or bizarre to us, is there is a sort of a thread of logic. And a lot of them come from medieval stories, like horseshoes with the devil being shod by a farrier and he drove the nail into the frog. So it's kind of this lap of something factually happening to go into your realm of folklore as well. Like, you know, the devil being cast into a boot, and then you've got kind of Bellarmine jars, like these witch jars that were little jars that were filled with things from, we would say urine, but as described as particularly historically piss, they'd always say, wouldn't they, with nails and things like this. And there were different thoughts as to whether it could be sort of voodoo kind of affecting the witch's bladder, things like this, other things that smelt stronger than a human, so the witch was attracted to them and then trapped in there. There's lots of different reasons why. And like the cat, you said about the concealed cats, this idea of a witch's familiar, the cat has this long history of kind of in a folkloric sense as well, but also could they were associated as being a witch's familiar, but also could kill a witch's familiar, the broomstick, which is phallic. You know, it's so interesting that factual things become folkloric. One thing I did want to talk about as well was just I suppose like two things, just interested on what your kind of thoughts were in terms of punishments, say witch punishments and dispelling certain things as well, and then what you kind of thought about the feminine thread in a witch trial. So if maybe we look at the punishments first. So I suppose one of the big misconceptions is this idea of when you think of a witch, you always go, burn her, which is this a Scottish thing that they burnt them, isn't there? And England, we hang them. The Scots, I didn't realise this until recently, actually, when I was reading about it, I thought it was interesting, had a slightly different system to us. So we had one whereby you have assizes courts and they would be trialled that way. But in Scotland, you could be, you know, like you could accuse me or vice versa, and then you could take that to a higher court, but you were more likely to have been killed, I suppose, because it was done, they sort of took them at their word rather than sending a jury out and an assizes court and things. So in Scotland, although comparatively a smaller area, they're responsible for a great many deaths in that way. The other thing I was going to talk about as well, and if you've got any other punishments worth adding, was this idea of ducking. So, you know, trial by ordeal. So a ducking stool, I think I'm right in thinking, usually was actually for scolds, wasn't it? For women kicking off.
Yeah.
The misconception that it was for drowning witches. Witches were generally, was it right that they tied their thumb and their toe and they threw them in? And this is a baptismal water, which I think is really interesting. And I have got a quote to read to you as well, but I thought this idea and things like the thumb screws, which are, is it fillywinks or something? I can never remember the right name. You know, all these horrible punishments. Have you got any that you sort of, you know, particularly stand out in your mind, or what you think, you know, why these choices were made? So the baptismal water, what do you make of this? Like, what's your theory in terms of how they chose these and what, you know, any that sort of stood out to you?
I think it links to misogyny. I think it all boils down.
I mean, that seems a huge surprise.
I know. I'm dropping truths here.
Yeah.
And I think...
Casual truth prom. Never think it was that.
I think...
Surely not.
It's the idea that this woman has caused suffering, so we have to cause suffering to her.
Yep.
And that can be so linked to internalized misogyny and those kind of things. But it's the idea that this woman has caused the cattle to fail, or there's suffering, some sort of suffering. That's a tongue twister.
That is, yeah, you did better than me.
So we need to give her that suffering too. But also there's a level of humiliation involved, particularly with things like the pillory, and which we see a lot in Shropshire when we do have references to either scolds or witches.
Yeah.
It's the pillory that tends to be one of the punishments, which is...
They're humiliating.
Yeah, it's like to humiliate. Bridal,
that's what they're for, yeah.
Yeah, and there were... Particularly when we talk about, like, the ducking stool. There was one in Shrewsbury, in the centre of Shrewsbury.
I didn't know that. It's really interesting. Okay.
Till quite late, really, in the 1800s.
Oh, bloody hell.
Like 1840s, I think. I might be wrong there, but certainly 1800s, there was a ducking stool
in
Shrewsbury. They should.
Yeah.
And the scold bridle as well was used relatively
Do you want to describe that for listeners as well, so in terms of rather than, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like a metal contraption that looks like something out of a Saw film. It is awful. And it kind of, it's some form of bar or contraption that it fits in the mouth.
It could sit on your tongue in some instances as well, yeah.
That is very painful. It's, in some instances, they're made to kind of cut into and fit quite badly. And it's meant to be a form of humiliation. If the woman has the audacity to talk or to be, you know, not the traditional idea of what a woman should be in that time, then she should be humiliated beyond anything. And those would be worn in public. Those would be something that everyone could see. And it must have been incredibly painful and traumatic to see that. And I think certainly within the Shropshire context, it's interesting that we have things like this.
Yeah.
But then also there's, it's slightly an aside, but there's a folklore of wife selling in Shropshire where...
Is that the Mayor of Casterbridge that happens?
Yeah.
Well, but yeah, go on, tell us
where you could...
Because this is going to be horrible, I imagine.
Yes. Yeah. So if you'd had enough of your wife, if she was a bit of a nag and you couldn't be bothered to go through the courts and get something like the Scald's Bridle...
Or ask, why is she a nag?
Yeah, why is she doing this?
Yeah.
You could take your wife to the market. And there was one on the Shropshire border and there's one in Staffordshire, and you could literally sell your wife. And there's one evidence anecdotally in folklore of a man threatening to do that with his wife, and she said, and then he kind of backed out and she was like, no, you will sell me. take me to market. Yeah. And she marches him all the way to market and sells herself.
Queen.
Essentially.
Love that.
And she had a very happy marriage afterwards.
Good for her. Because I was going to say, who's buying wives? Because that's probably going to be less than salubrious. But actually, maybe she'd arranged it. Maybe she'd already got a lover. She's like, look, mate, just turn up and buy me. And then we're okay.
I like
that. Get rid of this knobhead.
Yeah. So you've got all these... That. Instruments and these ways in which you can humiliate a woman and knock her back down.
Yeah.
And I think even if we take away the idea of witchcraft, so much of the punishments towards women in these kind of eras we're talking about are to harm or to punish that woman for getting ideas above her station or to be something other than that archetype of what she should be. And I think that's very much linked. And at the most extreme end, there's the hanging and there's that kind of thing. But even the ducking stool, the, you know, and the pillory and stuff like that, it's to make that woman feel less and feel small.
That's what they're doing constantly, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's interesting because even if you look at in terms of witch trials, the early days, so when they're kind of looking at their bodies and things like that, the sexual invasion of that, because they were looking for strange marks, including on and inside their genitals, they're looking at marks on their body. I mean, they're stripping these women naked, in some instances shaving their heads and things. I know that was more for heresy, but equally that still went on as well. And if we're kind of warming to the theme of misogyny, there is, of course, the king of misogyny with demonology is King James. We'll say the sixth first of Scotland, and then obviously in 1603, the first of England. But after his involvement with Berwick witch trials, which is very famous, I read this quote that he in Demonology that he wrote about the water test, which it appears that God hath appointed that the water shall refuse to receive them in her bosom, that has shaken off them the sacred water of baptism. I mean, fuck off, frankly. Like he's such a... He said, even by these three passions that are within ourselves... This is in... English is slightly harder to read as well, but curiosity in great imaginings, thrift of revenge for some thoughts deeply apprehended, or greedy appetite of gear caused through great poverty. As to the first of these, curiosity, it is only the enticement of magicians and necromancers, and the other two are the allures of the sorcerers or witches, for that old and crafty serpent, being a spirit, he easily pays our affections and so conforms himself thereto to deceive us to our wrath. I mean, he's going in a sort of a roundabout way of saying this, but he did the same when his witch, when they travelled, and there was that woman, I can't remember her name, but which is kind of playing into the misogyny here, isn't it, because I can't remember her name, but she described details of their wedding night. But you could do that because she was older and you could probably guess what went on between newlyweds that were younger. I mean, in terms of his misogyny and how he treats women, I think is just utterly abysmal. And the fact that he puts a name to it with his book, and there's this sort of arrogance to his attitude and his thorough knowledge of witchcraft that just makes you think, fuck off, frankly. And in some ways, I find him almost more insufferable than Cranmer. I think he's just... And I think Shakespeare, who, you know, amazing legend in a lot of ways, prolific brown noser with his Scottish play and the Three Witches and things, and the fact that further down the line that kind of was played by different artists kind of painting quite famous women in that scene. And then you've got things like Goya with his Witch's Sabbath. It's kind of thread through history and then reimagined and romanticized. But one of the things, and I suppose we should probably wrap up quite soon, but I thought was interesting, was this idea of the misogyny in witchcraft. So I think it's probably wrong, but see what you think, wrong to think it's solely that, but there is a lot of the sexual dominance of women. So if you look at even what might be in some respects a trope, but this idea of particularly, sadly, it wasn't uncommon, these young maidservants, things like this, that maybe some old fella took a shine to, like the Lord of the Manor.
Yeah.
And then if she wasn't interested, or she had a lover, or she took off with someone in the dead of night, and there's records of this happening, he would then haul her in and, you know, accuse her of abysmal things.
Yeah.
And later when witchcraft died down, they would accuse him of things like whores and things, and later they ended up being single mothers and various things that are all at the product of misogyny. But a lot of the witch trials were based on people that had these sexual proclivities that could not be acted out. And so their sexual domination was in getting these women put to trial and having their bodies probed and looked at. And I think that people like Matthew Hopkins must have had some sort of sexual suppression whereby the idea of perhaps sex repulsed him in some ways, but he exercised his peccadilloes via this. I cannot think that people like James I were solely on some Christian mission of goodness.
Yeah.
I think that's got to be at the crux of a lot of this, has to be sex in some weird, perverse way, do you think?
Yeah, and I think they go hand in hand, religious repression and repressed sexuality, particularly in the period that we're talking. Yeah, our bedfellows. And I think it's interesting to look at the wider trends with things like this, where sexuality is such a prominent feature, but then also look at it in within the Shropshire context where that doesn't really feature that much.
Yeah.
And I think within the Shropshire context, witchcraft continues due to how difficult and how hard life is in the area that we're looking at. So I have found very, very few evidences or folkloric stories in Shropshire from areas where there is not an incredibly difficult style of life. Mm-hmm. You have a pocket of them in the very agrarian South Shropshire, that kind of area where, as we know, is a very difficult life to live anyway. But within the early modern through to the Victorian, it was particularly difficult. Mm-hmm. But then also we have evidence of it from areas like Much Wenlock and kind of nearer to the East Shropshire coalfield, where life would have been incredibly different through the Industrial Revolution, where there would be a high death rate. There would be a number of cattle diseases and things that were going on in the South Shropshire side. So in Shropshire, witchcraft is incredibly linked to struggle and the adverse life experiences that people are having. And it goes back to that trying to control the uncontrollable.
Yeah.
My cattle are dead. My son is sick. I have nothing that I can do. So I have to do something to make this make sense to me. Yeah. So it must be that lady that lives on the, you know, peripheries of society. She's a bit strange, you know. It must be someone, because I'm a Christian and I can't believe that God would do this to me. And I do think within the Shropshire context, almost the sexuality side of it disappears, and it becomes a lot more to do with the inherent struggle of just existing and subsistence in these areas. And there are references to women that are a bit fruity, like we've got Nanny Morgan, my absolute favourite, who I'm sure I will badger on about in future episodes.
I hope so.
Who, you know, she got herself a toy boy at 60. She got a 30-year-old toy boy. So there's a clear inherent sexuality there. And there's old Dolly in Edgemond who walked around in short skirts and steeple hats. So she clearly was a style.
I love that.
Legend.
Yeah,
but
style icon.
There's an element of sexuality. But in Shropshire, there is a lot more struggle involved. And the idea that something as simple as an apple or the Bible can cause undue harm or death. So I think it's interesting, because in that regard, Shropshire is very different to there's some folkloric things where Shropshire actually carries on with the trend. Certainly some of the ghost archetypes we see in Shropshire, we see all over the country. There's certain things that we seem to do, but do better, like the devil folklore.
Yep.
So we have got such a concentration of devil folklore in Shropshire. it's all over Britain and further afield, but we have a lot here. But then there's some things like witchcraft that we have some of the similar traits with, maybe the ways in which we protect ourselves, but it is completely different here, or very different. And I think that's what's so fascinating about the area.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? And yeah. I think there's this, I suppose that thread of the idea of agriculture, of climate shifts, of sex, of all these things that kind of play, and you've got to pin the blame on something. And quite often it's pegged onto a woman. And Professor Ronald Hutton, whom we both are absolutely besottedly in love with, because he is a legend. He's not conventionally hot. He's no kind of hot man on his bike and across the long wind. Like, he's not the figure of athleticism, but he's just an academic babe, isn't he?
King.
King. Coolest man ever. And I suppose in a way, if it's the right place to end, unless you want to add something, I think going on from what you just said so articulately, he said that with men and women historically, that men could be taught witchcraft in terms of book learning and things like that, but women just had magic in them. And so his feeling was, even just as an aside or coexisting with the sexual aspect, is that is quite often where a lot is pegged onto them. But also in some instances, they would seek their advice, whether it be the Oracle at Delphi and going through to wise women, to there's a sort of a figure of wisdom in the female kind in Ireland as well. But this idea that women just had magic in them means that a lot has been pegged to them in good and bad instances, predominantly bad.
Yes, yeah. I think just briefly, that's very much the case in Shropshire. Dick Spot the Conjurer, Thomas Light. I just had to get his name.
You
again.
Have to, but you did it so beautifully.
Dick Spot.
And why not? If that was my name, I would just talk in the third person all the time.
The name's Spot. Dick Spot. So he learned his magic, very much like Hutton said. He was very profoundly educated in various tomes of...
But there could be no other career for him.
Yeah, with the
apart
occult.
From porn, you could do anything else. Like, that's it. Yeah.
And he's very linked to the occult.
Yeah.
The profane knowledge, the reading, having all these astrological and demonic tomes of books. Whereas women, it is a lot more something that they have. The only instance we do have of a woman having the audacity to read is Nanny Morgan.
Yeah.
And one of the things that was thrown against her was the fact that she had these books.
How bloody dare she?
How dare she? Now, we don't know whether these books were anything to do with witchcraft. There is some evidence there might be at least one of them. Mm. She might have just liked to read. But one of the things that was thrown against her in the community was the idea that she had these books of wicked arts and that she would use them to curse people, so she must be wicked. So she's the only real evidence we have in Shropshire of a witch that is educated in the occult reading, whereas with men, a lot of them, Thomas Light, Jack of the Wildmoors, they're all educated reading people. Mm. And I think that's why the community trusted them to do these things.
Yeah.
But I think that sums it up really well.
Yeah. That women just have magic in them.
Yeah.
But are not to be trusted.
Don't trust them.
Yeah. And for the most part, men can be decent, but invariably historically have not been. So that was amazing. I loved it. Thank you. So our first episode wrapped up and done. Our next episode will be on death omens and various things.
Yes,
as well.
Superstitions of death and dying in Shropshire.
God, look at us. We're a cheery pair. I love it. But thank you so much. See you next time. Bye, bye, bye.
Bye, bye. Bye. Bye.